the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Hey, we welcome you back. Another hour, you are just about to get more of the best in money information courtesy of the Bucket Strategy Investing Program. I'm Johnny Dean, got our returning champion, Professor Rick Plum, here with us once again from Lucia Capital Group. We're standing by ready to help you out with your money questions. Now, we got a lot of stuff to talk about this hour, stuff that we plan to talk about. We're going to get into it, but we're also going to get to more of your emails. And of course, we will make sure that we get to your phone calls as well. Right now, lines are open. If you're a new viewer or new listener, here's what you do. You call us with your money questions at 877-PLANNER, 877-PLANNER, and we answer those questions right here on the program. That's exactly how it works. Simple, huh? Again, the number, 877-752-6637, spells out PLANNER. We do try to deliver to you the strategies that are right for you, and we do this every day on this program. If you want to add to the list of emails that we'll be reading on the show this hour, you go over to wealthed.com, our website, wealthed.com. Click on the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. Professor Rick Plum, certified financial planner, he's here as always from Lucia Capital Group. We thank them for this hour of the program. If you need to talk to an advisor off the air, you can always call the professor or any of the Brain Trust advisors at Lucia Capital Group at their off-air number, 800-644-1150. 800-644-1150, off the air. Find out if your individual retirement goals and needs are being met. Your situation, of course, is unique to you. We showed that last hour. And the Brain Trust will help you with your own plan with access to a network of Brain Trust advisors across the country. Give us a call right here. Brain Trust here to help you out. Once again, on the air, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We got all the lines open right now. So if you've got a question, I would suggest you give us a call now. Talk to us about your situation, about your money. So I saw this headline. We were talking to the TV people about this. The 60-40 portfolio is dead, and it's not coming back. This was in Forbes. Now, when we talk about the 60-40, Professor.
That's kind of the traditional balanced portfolio that we've been talking about for the last, 100 years or so. I mean, it's a blended portfolio, and it's not as volatile technically, or it hasn't been in the past, as a pure stock market return. Mm-hmm. It's obviously more volatile than a very safe account like a CD or something of that nature. And as expected, you would see the return somewhere in the middle between CDs and a pure stock portfolio over long periods of time. And is it dead? You know, as the title says. Well, debt is kind of a relative issue in this case.
Well, it is. Now, I'll explain what they're talking about. Now, I should mention, and they do mention in this too, that
Performance.
Past performance, yes. But if you have the, if you own the spiders and you own the U.S. aggregate bond ETF, it's actually, they said, enjoying a fairly nice run so far in 2016, up a little more than 3% for the year, which is partially because some interest rates have still come down, I don't know how, and we've had a little bit of a comeback in the stock market. But, okay, nonetheless, here's what they say on this. Again, 877-PLANNER, our number. They said, let's play with the numbers. Back in 1980, the 10-year Treasury yielded a fat 11.1%, and stocks sported an earnings yield. Now, what they're talking about is earnings to price.
They turned the P.E. upside down. I don't know what that does. I haven't ever heard that statistic before, but not the yield. That's kind of almost, I don't know, what had happened was it was kind of a total return from the portfolio at that point.
Yeah, they're calling it an earnings yield of 13.5%. This implied, they say, a back-of-the-envelope portfolio return of about 12.5% per year going forward. And for much of the 1980s and 1990s, that proved to be a conservative estimate. Both stocks and bonds were priced to deliver stellar returns, and both most certainly did. Now, they go on to say this, but what about today? The 10-year Treasury yields a pathetic 1.6%, and the S&P 500 trades at an earnings yield of 4%.
Well, the actual earnings yield of the S&P is 2%. If you're using that ratio that they were using, the upside-down P.E., the
E.P. ratio,
I don't know how good of an indicator or projector of potential returns that is, so I'm not going to buy his premise that the total return expectation of a stock portfolio over a 10-15 year period of time is 4%. It could be, but I'm not buying that premise.
No. They said this gives you a blended portfolio expected return of an almost embarrassing 2.8%. So the point of this, they were saying.
So he's basically saying that you should expect a 2.8% rate of return out of a balanced portfolio going forward. Total return.
I'm assuming that's not taking any money out of it either.
No, this is not a withdrawal strategy. This is just the balanced portfolio going forward and thing. Now, I agree with part of what he's talking about. I do believe that the expectations of return should not be based on historical performances of balanced portfolios. But does it mean we should only expect a 2.8% rate of return? This last year, S&P didn't do very well. But a balanced portfolio should have more preponderance of dividend-paying stocks rather than growth stocks. So it's going to have a little bit different, makeup than just the straight S&P. Bonds, true, they are not paying very much. So we're not getting as good of an advantage, so to speak, of the interest-paying side of it being dollar-cost averaged into the volatility of the market like we used to get. We're only getting a marginal portion of that. So I do believe that balanced portfolios will do a lower return in the next several years, 5 to 10 to 15 years, than historical returns. But historical returns are correct, 12.5% over the 80s and 90s, well, that's an unrealistic expectation of a pure stock market return going forward.
Well, no, exactly. And I'm sorry, one of the things that he says on the bond yield on this Forbes article says that bond yields would have to go negative to even get, you can't even get close.
Well, he's trying to say that to get a total return that we've been receiving out of bonds as we had in the past, we'd have to go down to a -5, -10% rate of return on those bonds, which isn't going to happen, obviously.
No, of course not.
So there is a component. The bonds are going to drag on the portfolio, maybe more than helping it. And so I do agree that the balanced portfolios are not the same animal as they were back in the 80s and the 90s or even the early part of the 2000s. But does that mean they're dead? Does that mean that you shouldn't be using them at all? No, you can still use them. You just have to change your expectation, whether it's 2.8, 3, 4%. We're not using the same expectations of a balanced portfolio where we used to expect 6, 7% out of them. Mm-hmm. Now we're expecting 4, maybe 5% out of them over a 7 to 10, 15-year period of time. So we can still use them, but they're not dead. But you've heard us talk about structured products. You've heard us talk about index annuities. You've heard us talk about alternative investments. You've heard us talk about a lot of other things. And part of the reason we're talking about these other issues is because we need to find an alternative to the old game plan that was just put some money in cash, put some money in a balanced portfolio, and then maybe some money in stock, or just have one balanced portfolio for your whole portfolio. It doesn't work the same way. We've talked about the old games of just buying utility stocks and living off the dividend. That doesn't work anymore, like Grandma and Grandpa got away with. Talking about buying bonds and living off the interest rate. That doesn't work anymore, like Grandma and Grandpa used to do. Maybe now it's the balanced portfolio that doesn't work exactly the same way as it did in the past. Does it mean that those investments can't work within a portfolio that's designed around a certain area and calls for that type of an investment? No, they can still work. You just have to apply it in the right method and the right manner.
Now, so the question came down to this. If the old 60-40 is dead, and I don't think it is, but if it is, he says, what are investors supposed to do about it? Well, a couple of suggestions. If you don't like these paltry rates of return that they're predicting, first of all, consider taking a more active approach to investing. They say, don't be a buy and hold index investor. Instead, try focusing on value or momentum or a dividend-focused strategy. With a dividend strategy, you can realize a cash return even if the market goes nowhere for years at a time. That's one. Another one, investing outside the market. They talk about cash-flowing rental property. And we've talked about that a little bit too. Or consider a truly alternative asset allocation. Now, instead of a standard 60-40 stock bond portfolio, how about a 50-50 dividend stocks alternative investments portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, so you're replacing the stock component or the majority of the stock component with a different type of an asset that potentially has a higher yield. Trying to get back to what the more historical yields of the bonds were creating, you're trying to create that with the alternatives rather than a bond. It's still somewhat of a balanced portfolio. You do have different risk characteristics. Bonds are potentially, with the definition of liquidity today, liquid. You could sell them on any given day of any given week.
Sure,
the market's open. What you get for them depends on the interest rates, but you can turn them to cash very easily. Many of the alternatives that we're talking about, cash flowing real estate and some other things. You can't just sell it when you at any given moment. It takes time, it takes money, it takes effort to sell it. And so they're different animals. Does it mean that he's wrong? No, I don't have a problem with using alternatives in a portfolio where they're called for. But to just blindly replace the bonds in your balanced portfolio with alternatives, my first premise was having just a balanced portfolio isn't appropriate either. You need to have a strategy that outlines what you're doing and then put the right assets with it. Maybe that's a balanced portfolio. Maybe that's some alternatives. But in what percentage?
Exactly.
What percentage of the overall? How do I use the income that's coming from it? Do I use it to live off? Do I reinvest it? What am I doing with all these different assets? Use them to your advantage.
Yeah, and this is a problem again with some of this generic advice. It could work for certain people, but maybe horrible advice for somebody else. Okay, 877-PLANNER. We got some lines open. Give us a call. We'll take some of your calls again when we come back. Also get to some of your emails as well. If you want to email us, you can go to our website, wealthed.com. Wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealthed.com. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, Bucket Strategy Investing continues right after this. Welcome back to the program. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, 877-PLANNER, our number, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We do have a little bit of room on the phones right now, so if you want to give us a call, we'll be happy to talk to you about whatever issue is on your mind. 877-752-6637. Emails, of course, at wealthed.com, wealthed.com at the Find Your Answer link. We do have to get some emails, which we'll do in a little while. I want to take some more phone calls right now, though, at 877-PLANNER. We just had a couple folks hung up, so give us a call back if you're on hold. Let's move next, then, to Jim in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hello, Jim.
Hi, guys. I'd like to ask Professor Plum a question. What is the difference between an endowment annuity and a charitable annuity, and who's providing these, and how and where and when are they used and for what?
I'm not familiar necessarily with the term endowment annuity. All annuities have a maturity date where they technically, it endows when they, at some point, but I'm not sure. Now, when you say, and charitable annuities meant a lot of things. There's charitable gift annuities where you make a donation to a charity, and while you're alive or for some specific period of time, you receive an income stream. Charitable remainder annuities where you create a trust and you gift an asset to the trust, usually an appreciated asset. The asset is sold, because the charity is the remainderman, there's no tax at the sale, and you get to reinvest the entire things to create an income for yourself. So there's a difference in what we're trying to accomplish. What is it that you are trying to accomplish, and we'll see what we can do.
Well, I was talking with my attorney, and basically we were talking about ways of investing a chunk of dough and providing retirement income. And she was mentioning that she had done this making a charitable annuity with a college or university, mm-hmm. such as Harvard. And they were paying somewhere around 7.4%.
Okay.
She didn't have time to elaborate on this, but I was wondering, let's forget it, endowment, apparently that's
So it sounds like they're talking about a charitable gift annuity, where you make a charitable donation to some type of a charity or an endowment fund, like the Harvard Endowment Fund. And in turn, you receive an income stream for the rest of your life or, like I said, a specific period of time. Now, we have to be careful when they say they're earning 7.2% or they're being paid out 7.2%. So I make a gift of $100,000, $1 million, whatever the amount that I'm giving is. I give $100,000 and they pay me $7,200 a year, 7.2%. That's not an earnings rate. That's a payout rate. Now, because when I die, the income stops. If I die 1 year into it, the income stops, and the charity has the $100,000. They get it all. Or
exactly.
Maybe there's a term certain to it. But there's no asset coming back to me or my heirs when the term is up, whether it's my lifetime, a joint lifetime, or something like that. So we have to understand, is it a payout rate or is it an earnings rate? Now, how old are you, Jim?
71.
71, a 7.2, I would actually hope to try to, that's probably not a bad payout. And if you like the idea that the charity is going to get whatever money is left, after you're gone, that's fine. And so what you do, if you are looking for income, if you're looking for a way to create income, you look at what can you buy through the, you know, the private, I mean, through the regular annuity world. If I wanted an immediate annuity day and I gave it to XYZ big time insurance company, what would they pay me given the same exact payout parameters, life only, life with 10 years certain, whatever the, you know, joint life thing. What would they pay me? What would this charitable gift annuity pay me? And how strong do I believe in this charity? I mean, if it's just a small charity, maybe I'm not as trusting of it as if it's a huge, you know, United Way, or, you know, I don't even know if they do them, but some massive charity that I believe is actually going to be around for the next 30, 40 years.
Right. I think what puzzled me is when she mentioned that educational institutions such as Harvard and universities, that level, were providing these. I just wasn't aware of that. And she is younger than I am, and she's receiving supposedly 7.4%.
Oh, 7.4. Yeah, usually because they're not, they don't have to have the same requirements as a large insurance company, and they don't have the same potential profit margins that the insurance companies have. I've seen charitable gift annuities payout rates a little bit higher than what you can get in the outside world.
Right. And but, plus, Harvard a few years ago had like a $35 billion endowment fund. It was just.
Right. They're the big ones.
So, you know, maybe they have a little more flexibility or wiggle room.
Well, and we've seen that the endowment funds like the Harvard Endowment, the Yale Endowment, and some of the other very large, especially Ivy schools, their ability to invest has been very, very consistent. They tend, you know, people write up about how consistent they are and how they're doing. They every once in a while have a downtime too. But so they've been able to do what they say they're doing. So those are large endowment charities, and
right.
It's not uncommon.
The other reason I called you don't hear much discussion about the Ivy League institutions, colleges, and other ones. And their rates of payout and stuff like that. And I think people might be interested in this.
They might be. You know, it doesn't have to be one of those. There are some very large medical, you know, hospital chains across the U.S. that do these.
Even better then. So it's just an area that doesn't get much light shown on it. So
yeah, and all of this, though, deals with, you know, you're 71-ish. So let's say they pay you 8%, $8,000 a year. If it's a single life payout, you got to live like 12.8 years just to get your own money back. So you've got to. And so the rate of return is, you know, remember when the first thing I said was don't confuse payout with rate of return. And so some people will look at it and say, you know, if I've got to live to be 94 to get a 3 or 4% rate of return, I don't know the math on these contracts that you're talking about yet, but if I've got to live to be 94 to get a 3 or 4% rate of return, then I'm not all that thrilled with it.
Oh, I understand. She said she was receiving 7.4.
Right, 7.4. Yeah. So what her real rate of return is will be, you can't know what her real rate of return is until we have one final piece of the puzzle, which is how long it lasted. And that means we have to know when she did die or when she will die. If she lives to be 105, this would be a great thing.
Let me ask one final question. Is there some kind of tax deferral strategy on this where somebody could have a chunk of dough that they're going to receive and they could have it made payable directly to the charitable annuity, bypassing them, and where they would just receiver would receive the income?
It depends on where the money is coming from. If it's an income that you've earned, or, you know, similar to like an IRA or some kind of deferred account like that, then even if I give that income away, it's still going to be taxed to me if I give it to the charity. I'll get the charitable deduction potentially by giving at least some of it to the charity. So it depends on where the income is coming from. If it's a large capital gain on an asset that I have that I haven't sold, and I give the asset to the charity, yeah, I get to forego that capital gain because I didn't experience it. The asset went over to the charity. The charity experienced it. So yeah, there are ways around some things.
Yeah, and sometimes that can work well. Jim, if you have any other questions, hold on. We can talk to you more about it on the other side of the break. Yeah, but we do have to take a break here. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Room on the phones. Ask your money questions. The Brain Trust is here to answer those questions when we come back on Bucket Strategy Investing. PLANNER, our number, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Get on board. And we all of a sudden got a bunch of room on the phones. Is it something we said? Did I say something? Did I insult our callers somehow? Or they decided they didn't want to hold on? Okay, that's fine. 877-PLANNER, you give us a call back, and we'll talk to you more about your dough. We don't talk about this all that often, but we'll throw it in that the Fed did not raise their interest rates. They didn't lower them. They didn't raise them. They didn't do anything with them. And they said, Professor Plum, that they're going to signal two interest rate hikes still.
Well, they still plan on doing two
year. But we know what that means. So what they're saying is we're preparing you, and yet if they don't, this is the whole problem with the Fed telling everybody what's going to happen next, you know? I mean,
was it easier listening to Greenspan and trying to figure out what he was saying, or listening to them and still not having a clue what they're saying?
I don't know. I thought it would be easier this way, but now I'm not so sure. The 10-year is down to what now? It's below 1.6.
It's 1.58 at the moment.
1.58.
Time to refi.
I wonder. I mean, I'd love to check mortgage rates coming up here. We'll talk to Steve Aldor maybe next Tuesday and see what Steve has to say about these things. But my gosh, wow. Okay, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. Once again, if you want to email us, you can go to our website, wealthed.com, wealthed.com. Let's see, the email next is, boy, there's a long one. Okay, let's go to Olga then in Orlando, Florida. Olga says, I am a 65-year-old widow. I have a rental property that I have been renting over a 10-year period. My question is, if now I make it my principal residence, do I avoid paying big taxes when I sell it? Thank you.
Well, I'm going to assume that you've been a widow for the entire 10-year period of time. It depends on what happened when your spouse passed away, whether it was in their name, your name, and if they passed away in the last 10 years, we have a whole change of some tax laws. But if you're a widow the entire time, you've had a property since 2006 that you've been renting out. And if you move back into it now as a primary residence and you set it up as a primary residence for at least 2 years, when you do sell it at the end of the 2 year period of time or when you sell it as a primary residence, you will be able to say, yes, I have lived in it for 2 years and I've owned it for at least 2 years. I've lived in it as my primary residence for 2 years. So I will be eligible for the primary residence exclusion of gain. However, you will not be able to take the entire amount of gain that you have on the property and exclude it from tax. There's a rule that went in, 8 years now. Any ownership period of time prior to a primary residence time. So you've owned it before you turned it into your primary residence. Any ownership time after 2008, where it was not your primary residence, is going to be looked at as unexcludable gain. I guess if that's the only way to look at it, they're going to take the number of months that you owned it as a non-primary residence after 2008, divided by the total number of months that you've owned it, and they're going to say that resulting percentage cannot be excluded. So since 2008, let's say you turn it into a rental here in a couple of years at the beginning of 2009. You've owned it for 10 years. Well, let's go to the beginning of 2017. Excuse me. You've owned it for 8 years after 2008 as a non-primary residence. And then you move into it, and you live in it for two more years as a primary residence. So I'm going to just start the ownership at the beginning of 2009. You've owned it for 10 years. It was 8 years as something other than a primary residence. That's 80% of the time that you owned it as a non-primary residence. That means 80% of the gain cannot be excluded by the primary residence exclusion.
So if she has $100,000 worth of gain on this particular property, $80,000 of it is not protected.
Only $20,000 of it would be excludable. And you could then use the $250,000 exclusion to do that. Now, yours isn't exactly that way because you've owned it for a little longer, because they do count the entire ownership time for the denominator in this particular math equation. They only count the number of months after 2008 that it was not your primary residence in the numerator. That's the top number on a fraction. So when you're doing the division, if you've owned it for a long time, some people have owned these rental properties since like 1960. And so if they move back into it now, the majority of the time, it was not, they're only counting the years after 2008 that it wasn't a primary residence. And that's a small number compared to the whole thing.
So you'll be able to take most of the exclusion if
and
that's
that
the case.
Yeah. But for somebody who bought a property on or near the end of 2008, anytime after 2008, all that time that it was not your primary residence is going to count against you when you actually sell it as your primary residence. And that was a fairly new rule. They put that in 2008.
It used to be, once again, it used to be easy. It used to be where you could just move back into it. Didn't matter how long you've rented it. You've had it out as a rental. You could move back into it, live in it for 2 years. Once you've established it, two out of the last 5 years residence, primary residence, and own it for that period of time. You could sell it and get the entire capital gains tax exclusion.
You could use the entire $250,000 for a single person, the entire $500,000, even though you might have owned it for 10 years as a rental and only 2 years as a primary residence. That rule is gone. We have to do this proration thing. When there's a period of time that you own the property and it wasn't your primary residence before you made it your primary residence. So anytime you take a vacation house, a former rental, just a second house that maybe your parents were living in, your kids were living in, or whatever the case may be, and then you move into it and establish it as your primary residence after it was something else, you've got this proration. You've got this problem. If any of that non-primary residence time was after 2008.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's been made a lot more complicated. Now, in her case, she's widowed. That was the answer you gave.
That's assuming she was widowed the entire time.
Okay, now we don't know because if she had a husband, if they had both owned it jointly and, maybe he passed away a year or two ago.
Right.
She's got a potential.
Well there would have been a potential step up in basis. Mm-hmm. But Florida is a separate property state, so it depended on how they owned it. Was it in her name alone? Was it in his name? And that's why when it comes to, the fact that she's a widow, we don't know when she became a widow. It's all about this proration issue, and whether the gain is a lot of gain or a little gain, it's going to be pro rata on the sale.
All right, 877-PLANNER. Once again, if you've got questions, give us a call. We got some lines open, 877-PLANNER, Lucia or Lucia, either one, in Dallas, Texas. Hi. My spouse and I are small business owners. Since leaving our corporate jobs, I haven't moved my 401k or started a new savings plan. What's the best way to start saving again? IRA? I'm also concerned with insurance needs like disability and life insurance, but I don't know how to start. I'm 45 years old. That's Lucia in Dallas, Texas.
Well, starting with a good financial planner will help you solve most of these needs. Now, what kind of retirement plan you need? That depends on a lot of factors. You're a small business owner. Do you have any employees? Do you have a lot of excess cash, high income that you want to try to shelter? You're getting into the age where you've got a lot of options, but it depends on how many employees and what your budget is. So there's a couple things when you're looking at creating a retirement plan. How many employees is key? What my budget will be is key. How much flexibility I have in that budget or need in that budget from year to year, that is key. How much do I want to potentially put into the plan for others, meaning employees, is a key issue. And so when we start talking about retirement planning, or actually retirement plan planning.
Yes, strategy planning is what this is.
We have to, what kind of plan fits the best for your particular business? We have to look at these different issues. Now, the best way to plan for any type of savings or investment goal in the future is to make it as automatic as possible. To take the idea out of your hands of, I forgot to save this month, or yeah, I need to save this month. Make it automatic. And you're a small business owner, so we need to look at how you've got yourself structured. If you're self-employed, it's a little bit harder, but we can still set up automatics. If you are a corporation, you're paying yourself a salary and you're using a payroll company, very easy to set it up, and they will just take it away before you ever see it. They'll just tell you how much you have to put into the payroll account, and they'll take it in about putting it here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like they do with your withholding and everything else you're doing. Which plan? That becomes more difficult because there's a lot of factors. But as far as the other sides of it, disability insurance, health
insurance, right?
Those, you need to talk with a good financial planner, and they'll help you out in all those.
Yeah, determining how much, that's another subject for another time. But this is another big question that we get quite often, which is how much life insurance do I need? How much should I, what is optimal for me? Nobody wants to overpay for life insurance or get too much.
What type should I be buying?
And what type should you be buying? Exactly.
How much should I buy? And it all depends on if it's just you and your husband, or it is Lucia, right?
Yes.
If it's just you and your spouse, you may not need a whole lot of insurance. Because you don't have kids or other things. If you have kids, though, that are younger kids, maybe you do need some insurance or a lot more insurance. So it's all about those issues. Disability at 45 is a key thing, though, especially for a business owner.
And the good thing is time's on your side because you are only 45. It might seem old to you, but actually for retirement planning, it's not. You've got some options available to you. I would guess you'd be working at least another 20 years. With luck. Okay, 877-PLANNER, our number. PLANNER. Questions, answers, it all happens when we come back. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, don't go away. Phone lines open, 877-PLANNER. Not a lot of time to get to the phone, so if you have questions, I would suggest you get on board now, 877-752-6637. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum here from Lucia Capital Group, talking to you every day about your money, and we had a great discussion earlier today. I hope you heard it, at least in our first hour, heard and saw it with Chris Lloyd, who joined us from the Phoenix office, and he gave a great talk and explained, I thought, very well the sort of new way of pitching, marketing, and getting people into the office.
People in the office. It wasn't actually pitching and marketing. Once they got you in the office, it was the same old pitch, but it was a new way to get you to come into their office without understanding that you were coming into their office for an annuity sale.
We'll tell you what's coming up in just a second, but it was an interesting discussion, Professor. Now, he was saying that these folks are just asking people to come in and sign and get documents as a document
estate
provider.
Plan. They're coming in from an estate planning angle.
So what were they doing?
There are people, very legitimate, called registered document providers or certified document providers. Each state has a little bit different terminology. It's for people who just want the document. They don't want to design. They're just going to basically fill out a boilerplate. It's not a legal, you're not getting legal advice from these individuals. You're just getting the trust, the power of attorney, the whatever the case. You're just getting the document from them. And they don't charge you anywhere near as much as an attorney because they're not giving you any legal advice. They're not allowed to. They're not attorneys. But while you're there and you've basically shared all your financial information with them to try to, at least get a little idea of what kind of a financial documents you need, they take a look or they let somebody else take a look at your portfolios and say, hey, you've told us that maintaining this estate for your heirs is a primary concern, which is one of the reasons you're there, right? If you didn't care about preserving some of the estate to the heirs, you wouldn't be doing the financial documents in the first place. And we noticed that you've got these managed accounts, mutual funds,
variable
investments,
annuities, whatever
annuity,
it is, yeah.
All this, they're risky. You don't want risk. You want safety. You want good stuff.
Just came in for documents, but I just happened to be in the hallway, and showed our Fred down the hall.
Yeah.
Your personal information and your portfolio, and he's still on the floor. He can't believe that you still have this. So
goals that you've said you have, these assets are just way out of line.
So
you need to do XYZ because it is a stock market like return. It's a guaranteed 52% a day per return. It's and they make up all this stuff. I mean, but now they've got you in the office. Whereas if you had heard those marketing pitches without being in the office, you would have kind of maybe discounted it. But now you're not. If we can get you in the office, we got a better chance of making a sale.
That's what he is seeing. That's what Chris Lloyd had been seeing some of these places do. Now, there are legitimate document providers, and it's nothing wrong with that. But when they start saying, okay, by the way, I know you came in for this, but here's what else we need. You need this, 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 and this. Sign here on the dotted line. Thank you very much. You got to be very careful.
When you go in for one discipline, estate planning, and you start getting pitched a complete different area that you weren't even looking for advice, maybe you should think twice about it.
That's right. And it's one of the reasons you call this show. It's one of the reasons you talk to people like Professor Plum or Chris Lloyd. Just get a second opinion. Hey, is this right for me? Maybe it is. And if it is, great. Do it. But if it's not, hey, you know what? They did you a disservice. Okay, now coming up tomorrow, we were mentioning estate planning. We are going to be talking about this very subject in the first hour tomorrow. It has to do with creating an effective estate plan or just creating an estate plan. What are some of the components that you need? What should you be thinking about in your estate plan? You know, there are people who believe that it's only for people with multi-millions of dollars, you know? You think about I said this before, the word estate. The word estate conjures up images of terror.
I was 27, 28. I didn't have an estate to plan. Actually, I did. I had life insurance.
Yes, you did.
And I had young kids.
And you had young kids, and maybe you owned a home or you had assets. And there are things that you need to prepare for. Doesn't matter if you're young, whatever. And it's, of course, even more important, perhaps, if you are older and you have a lot more stuff. But creating an estate plan, what do you need to know about it? So we're going to talk about that tomorrow on this program. Time for trivia? Sure. Financial Times, I don't know what to make of this, but Financial Times said this needs to be urgently read. They sent this over the teletype machine as an urgent bulletin.
Teletype.
Publicly held debt of the United States, $14 trillion.
I thought the publicly held debt was more like $19
trillion. Well, no, it's just this, the public. This is what the we government. Actually. Yeah, it's how much we own in bonds.
Okay.
Yeah.
We the public, not the government.
Exactly. Not government or other countries. $14 trillion is equal to 76% of the size of the U.S. economy. Publicly held debt of China, $28 trillion, now that's stated in dollars, is equal to 200% of the size of the Chinese economy. Okay.
A little bigger.
It is. I fail to see really the...
What's the relevance?
I mean, okay, so what? The size of the economy? We, all of us in the public, you and I, and we were talking about this before, you own bonds. You might own treasuries, right? This is what we're talking about. You put your money inside of a treasury. You put 10 grand in a treasury, you've added to the U.S. debt. So what? Doesn't mean anything. It's perfectly safe. You can get to it at any time. If you call the debt, they'll just transfer it from your savings to your checking. That's all that means. So I'm not sure that that's necessarily a big deal, but... Now, this goes back also to the discussion of bonds. We saw the Fed earlier this hour. We noted that the Fed said we're leaving bond rates unchanged.
Again.
Not that that's any big deal. But we saw, and I don't know that this is actually a cause and effect at all, but then the 10-year happened to...
It dropped right when they did it. But it didn't drop tremendously. It went from like
1.61
to 1.58.
But again, once again, we're creating this downward cycle of interest rates. And I don't frankly get what the problem is. What is the problem? They left it open. In fact, they announced that twice this year, before the end of the year, they expect to raise interest rates. They expect interest rates two more times before the end of the year.
They expect to raise interest rates twice.
Right, exactly. Now, I counted, Professor Plum. There will be fewer than 6 months left very shortly in the year, okay? They've been so afraid to pull the trigger, and yet they're saying that they're going to do it twice before the end of the year.
Well, they've already met for June, so we can discount June.
That. So that's what
you
I mean.
Got 6 months left.
6 months left. Now, the next time that they're going to meet, whether it's 6, 8, 10 weeks, I don't know, whatever it is, nothing's probably going to happen then. It's going to be the meeting after that.
Right.
So what are they going to do? They're going to do it in September, and they're going to do it in December.
Maybe. Well, they have to then, because those are the only ones that they actually announced rate changes on.
Well, and that's the thing. So what are they going to do? They're scheduling those two? Frankly, I don't see it happening.
You know, everybody was pretty sure that they were going to raise rates because all indications were, until they got the jobs report and some other things, nobody knows what's going on. They don't know what's going on.
They don't. No guts. Okay, we're out of time. If you are on hold, hang on. We'll talk to you off the air. If we didn't get your email, we'll get to it tomorrow. If you need the Brain Trust off the air, you can talk to Professor Rick Plum or any of the advisors from Lucia Capital Group. Their off-air number goes like this, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. 1150. That's all the time we have for today. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. This is Buckett Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.